Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from. A curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. No matter how much you choose to give, you'll feel awesome next time you tune in, knowing that we wouldn't be here without you. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Plus, we have great member swag. Show off your HRN pride with a t-shirt or keep your hands safe in the kitchen with an HRN potholder. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and In the Drink is the show that brings you some of the most interesting people in the beverage industry. I do want to let you know that today's show is actually a pre-record. We're recording this during our summer break, so you're probably going to be listening to this in about 2 or 3 weeks after we've recorded. And during the time that we were on break, there's been a little bit of an announcement from myself. So I'm, you know, it's my show. I get to do a little shameless self plug. Why not? My new restaurant, Fausto, was announced in the New York Times. We're going to open up in the former Franny's space. My partner, the chef Aaron Chambour, and I were big Franny's fans. We love the restaurant and we're sad to see it go, but really excited about what we can do in that space. And hopefully you'll have another great place to drink wine in Brooklyn. Thank you, David. Thank you very much. Speaking of drinking wine in Brooklyn, I have one of my neighbors lives right down the block from me. And it's a shame that we don't hang out more often. Whenever we do, it's a great time. And I'm glad that we could bring him here in studio today. We have Charles Anton, who's the senior international wine specialist and auctioneer at Zacky's Wine Auctions. He does a ton of charity work as well. He's drinking great wine all the time. Just an all-around interesting, amazing guy. He's written for a bunch of other publications, including New York Times, Punch, Food and Wine. He also has an MFA in fiction from NYU, my alma mater. There's a lot more kinds of stuff. I feel like, you have a commercial pilot's license.
I do, yeah. I haven't flown in a long time, though. I wouldn't trust myself behind the yoke right now, but
it's not like riding a bike.
I've never tested it. It was another career path in a former life that, it doesn't mesh so well with the drinking but I decided not to go down that road. I did have a fantasy about becoming like a bush pilot in Botswana or something like that, and and you know, spending my 20s doing that. But
do you ever get? Do you ever? I mean, does anyone ever say to you, "Hey, if there's ever like a you know, a competition for who's like going to be the next most interesting man in the world, is it?" You should like throw your name in the hat.
No. I mean, my, you know, I don't know that I'm that interesting. I have a lot of like silly licenses and things, like, you know, but I don't know if that makes me qualifies me as most interesting. I have like, you know, my scuba license, my pilot's license, my forklift license, my.
You can relate to, well, that's the thing about that. He could relate to anybody.
Yeah, right. The forklift driver or the pilot or the private jet owner. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's generous of you, I would say, but I appreciate it. I did. I do have a. I was a certified competition judge for the Kentucky Barbecue, Kansas City Barbecue Society, for a while.
Now, of all the things that you like, your potential career paths, this is the one that I would most be interested in doing for myself.
I don't think it was ever quite at the career path level, but yeah, I had to quit because, you know, when you judge a barbecue competition, you're taking a bite of each one, and it's not like a wine tasting where you spit, you know, you're not spitting out like a half chewed rib or something like that. You swallow it. So even if you're minimizing the amount of intake on barbecue, like you judge a competition, you're eating like 4 or 5 pounds of barbecue. And it takes me every ounce of my willpower to stay at my current weight, and like spending my summer eating barbecue every weekend, like to the tune of like 5 or 6 pounds was not going to work out well. Like the people who are really good at it, you know, they really invest some time and probably maybe a few years off the end of their life in doing that. The other thing about barbecue, intense, right, is like when it comes to the serious competitions, there's not that many in the Northeast, like at least that are sanctioned by the Kansas City Barbecue Society, I found. There's great barbecue in New York for sure, but in the terms of the competitions, you know, you kind of got to go to the epicenters of barbecue in this country. And for that particular society, it's Kansas City.
Okay. So. I mean, this is a wine show, but I want to ask you two quick questions about barbecue judge. Number one, is there a marked difference between like competition meat and like what you might get at like hometown barbecue, which I love?
Yeah. Well, so the competition, the way they do it is you're judged on the specific categories of barbecue, and they present it to you in a way that's supposed to look attractive, and it's supposed to be uniform so that every competitor is presenting it in the same way. And they present it in a little styrofoam clam thing with like a piece of parsley.
That's interesting. And, that's a nice flourish.
Yeah. Nice flourish. Exactly. Cause you judge it on looks, you know, no one wants like disgusting looking ribs.
Is there palate fatigue? Is there the same way that maybe like if you taste like 100 Cabernets, like there's no way that 100th Cabernet you're like as excited about as the first one?
Well, yeah, for me, yeah. I mean, I don't want anyone to think that I'm even remotely knowledgeable about barbecue. Like anyone can become a Kansas City Barbecue Society certified judge. It takes you actually, and this is not a joke, they make you take a course, and obviously you have to pay a fee, which is the real reason you have to take the course. And then they actually make you raise your hand and take an oath to uphold the, you know, barbecue tradition in this country. I honestly didn't do it enough to really become sort of ensconced in barbecue culture. So it was fun to do for a while, but I do not think of myself as a barbecue expert. That's
okay.
For sure.
last one, barbecue. Where would you favorite eat barbecue in New York? Or? No, not
favorite. Where would I eat barbecue in New York?
Yeah.
I eat barbecue and for the reasons I said before, I don't eat barbecue that often anymore. But when I do, it's usually in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, and I go to, you know, Dinosaur, which is right there. But
I love the wings. Okay, so you had all these potential. I guess that's not barbecue.
No, it's barbecue.
That's barbecue.
Yeah.
Because it's smoke and heat and all that stuff. You had all these opportunities. It seems like, you know, you had this MFA in writing. You're a really talented writer. I've read a bunch of your articles. You could have been a commercial airline pilot or someone who was like a bush pilot, which I'm not even positive what that is, other than it's not the commercial airline pilot. And you ended up being a, you know, like the top of the industry in the wine auction world and working at just this outstanding company that seems to just be having a huge amount of growth. How did you get to do this?
I came to wine in my mid to late 20s, I would say. And, you know, I don't have a great genesis story. I mean, I was just sort of bitten by the bug, got interested in it, started reading about wine, tasting what I could afford. And I lived in France prior to that, but even that wasn't really, I mean, when I lived in France, I was drinking, you know, Kronenbourg, pastis, you know, I was living on like 600 euros a month, teaching English, and, I lived on the mouth of the Loire River, which, you know, isn't that far as the crow flies from, some pretty major wine regions, from Bordeaux, but, never went to Bordeaux, never really tasted all that much wine. And, when I came back, there wasn't one thing. It was just, I really didn't like what I was doing, the job that I had at the time. And got interested in wine, started reading about it, started looking into the types of jobs you can have in the wine business. And I wasn't necessarily interested or, you know, I didn't have any ins in the restaurant industry, and it wasn't something that I was interested in, mainly because none of my friends worked in the restaurant industry, and just the time, you know, it's my friends were home in the evenings and at work during the day, and I kind of wanted to have that same schedule. And I wasn't really interested in, you know, distribution. Obviously, when you live in New York City, working in production is a little tricky because not all that many vineyards in Manhattan. And, you know, I came across a job at an auction house, and it was Sotheby's, actually, and applied and didn't get the job, and applied for a job at Christie's and didn't get that job. And then Christie's called me back 3 months later. And offered me basically what was an entry-level position in the wine department there. So I started at an entry-level position in the wine department at Christie's, which was, and you know, Christie's was the sort of original wine auction house. Christie's is fond of saying that their first auction in 1766 was in part a wine auction. You know, it was a estate sale, but the estate included wine. And then, you know, flash forward a couple hundred years, Michael Broadbent started selling wine at auction at Christie's London in, I believe, the 60s, I want to say, and later came to Chicago for a bit, and also, obviously, New York. And so I thought it was a good place to be, and I started there and sort of worked my way up.
And Leah, what was that path like working your way up? What were the different milestones that you reached?
It started for me, you know, at the time, I didn't know anything. I mean, the entry-level position at Christie's, you didn't have to be so wine knowledgeable. It was more of a administrative position. So, you know, to me, it was just learning about the wines, learning about the industry, how auctions work, how the business of selling wine at auction works. And then obviously learning about the wines you sell. I mean, whatever area of the wine business you're in, you're going to learn sort of niche knowledge that has to do with that business. And part of it, obviously, are the wines themselves. I mean, auction is very focused on the most rare and expensive wines in the world. But, you know, a lot of it also has to do with the nuts and bolts of running the auction. Whereas I'm sure if you work at a restaurant, you've got to know the types of wines you sell in your restaurant, but there's also a hell of a lot that goes on the business side of things and making sure everything's running smoothly. So I did that for a couple of years, and I found that it was really interesting and it suited me. And, I hung out, and eventually I was promoted a couple times until I started doing, you know, the term in the business is wine specialist, but it's really wine auction specialist. Start working with clients, bringing in private consignments, and it went from there.
And so what was driving you during this time? Because I know you were simultaneously working on your writing and getting your MFA, right? I imagine that was happening about the same time. But what was driving you to keep going further and further with wine? What was most motivating you?
You know, part of the thing that helped me a lot, and this is probably not the answer that you, it's not all that inspirational, but to be honest, I got my MFA from NYU, and I did it half time while I was working at Christie's. And, you know, one thing that sort of kept me going at a day job, and no matter how fun and enjoyable your day job is, it's still a day job. Is, you know, having other outlets for your creativity and things you do in your life. So I've always, you know, going back to just like flying or, you know, judging barbecue or something like that, you know, I think at least for me in my personal life, if you start to go down the rabbit hole too much in one aspect of your life, whether it's your job or a specific hobby or something like that, I tend to get bored's not the right word. I tend to lose interest.
Yeah.
I think.
And so if it was like an all encompassing 100-hour work right. week, and you probably, maybe you wouldn't still be working with wine. Since it allowed you to have this job that you enjoy, that you're passionate about, but also it let you explore your other passions. That's
exactly right. Well. You know, yeah. as an entry-level position, it was a 9-to-5 job. It's not anymore really for me, unfortunately. But you know, during that time, I was able to publish short fiction. I was able to, in like the VQR and Glimmer Train. I mean, I was able to write for Food and Wine magazine, and have a job that was still pretty cool. I mean, even though I was doing administrative work, it wasn't like, you know, working in a diamond mine. It was still pretty cool, and I got to taste some rare wines.
Yeah, there are wines. Like, what was the office like? I pictured silver trays with fancy wines around all the time.
You know, at that time, it actually kind of was. You know, my interview, I remember I was called into Christie's, 20 Rockefeller Plaza, and I had been cooking earlier, and I had sliced my finger open pretty badly. Didn't need stitches, but you know, if you slice the tip of your finger, it bleeds quite a bit. I mean, it's a sensitive area, a lot of blood vessels. It was bleeding quite a bit. It was my left hand. And I wrapped it in a bandage and went into the interview at Christie's at 20 Rockefeller Plaza. And I'll always remember that I was sitting there being interviewed with the guy who was then head of the department, and I want to say like butler. He was like a service guy, came in and he asked if we needed anything. And the head of the department said tea would be great. And he actually brought in tea on a silver tea service. So, you know, I think in some ways Christie's is trying to live up to the facade of the most utterly ridiculous, like British, you know, stereotype
check out all the stuff we have.
Yeah. So I'm there drinking tea and, you know, answering questions, you know, what's your favorite wine? Where do you see yourself in 5 years? Things like that. And meanwhile, my left hand is just bleeding profusely and the bandage is filling up with blood. And so I'm sipping tea with my right hand. And eventually, you know, we got up to go and shook my hand. And, you know, like I said, luckily it was my left hand. I shook with my right. You know, I think I was a little woozy from the blood loss. So maybe he saw that for like a certain aloofness that people look for when dealing with the super wealthy. I don't know. But yeah.
Or maybe he thought you really love wine and you were partaking earlier that day.
Yeah, exactly. And exactly.
That was maybe the positive for it.
But I got the job and the office, you know, the upside, I would say, is that you do get to taste some really rare wines and drink them with clients. And those clients have become friends over the years. And, you know, they're not wines that I would necessarily find or could necessarily afford on my own. You get an interesting introduction to that. You get to travel the world meeting these people. You know, the downside is the day to day. It's like any other job, right? It's a lot of spreadsheets. Yeah. And, you know, you are moving a luxury product from wealthy people to other wealthy people, which isn't exactly God's work, but it must be
interesting to be like someone who's young and like, you know, trying to make it. And to deal with people who are like extremely wealthy and like you see what they're like spending regularly on their products. And there's like a mutually beneficial experience there, but also, I don't know, it must be very strange to you.
Yeah, it's pretty strange, you know. I mean, how, you know, it's an interesting topic, you know, just in general, like luxury goods in general, whether it's wine, whether it's, you know, a car, you know, a $100,000 car, even a $50,000 car doesn't get you from point A to point B necessarily better, you know, than a $10,000 car, a $5,000 car, a $2,000 car. But, you know, people want certain brands for certain reasons. You know, people spend money on different things for different reasons. People have different amounts of money, obviously. So, but there is, you know, spending $300,000, $400,000 on a case of wine, there can be something a little bit gross about that at times.
Unless it's for charity, right? And you do a ton of charity work.
I do. Yeah, I do a lot of charity auctions these days. I'm doing something like 65 charity auctions a year. A lot of them don't have anything to do with wine, though, to be honest with you.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, so later in my career at Christie's, I became an auctioneer, both in the commercial side and the charity side. And since then, I've sort of grown that aspect of what I do. And I've worked with every organization from Planned Parenthood to the Brady Center for the Prevention of Gun Violence to the Nashville Wine Auction to lots of private and public schools in New York City. Like last year alone, I did charity auctions everywhere from Nashville to Puerto Rico to Los Angeles to Hong Kong all over the place.
That's amazing. I really commend you for that work. And I think there's more potential and possibility for the wine industry to give back. There was an event that I did every year for the university settlement that I don't think is happening mm-hmm. anymore.
Yeah, I remember it. I actually heard that event for them. I don't know if it's the same one, but
yeah, and they use the wine industry and love of wine to like to really give back and do a ton of good. And I think there's more potential for that. I want to ask you: do you remember your first auction? Like, how did that even come about? To that, hey, you know, you're a wine specialist, but do most wine specialists end up doing auctions or
On the like a commercial auction? At
yeah,
Christie's?
A commercial auction.
Yeah, I mean the way that it worked. Is you have to audition, and being an auctioneer is about standing in front of a group of people and being able to talk. And like some people, completely normal conversation with them, but they're just not public speakers. Like they get up in front of a crowd and they just freeze. And if that's you, auctioneering is probably not for you. You have to, have some facility with language in front of a crowd. So you try out, and then once you it seems like you're good. You're trained on the what's called the footing. I don't know if we need to go into like the minutia of
it's
auctioneering.
Kind of interesting, actually. Yeah,
it's interesting.
What's the footing? Yeah.
So the footing is, at an auction, there are absentee bids, and someone might leave an absentee bid of $1,000, and then you might have a bidder in the room bidding against the absentee bid, and I'll look down as the auctioneer at the auctioneer's book, and see that I have an absentee bid of $1,000. Now, if someone in the room wants to bid $900, if I call for $900, they raise their hand at $900, I have $950, which is a book bid, and then they raise their hand at $1,000, we have a problem because the person in the room is bidding $1,000, I have an absentee bid of $1,000. Mm-hmm. So the footing is just making sure that where you open the bidding, where you accept the bids, you're always having people bid against each other and not on the same foot.
Mm.
So in other words, you would open the bidding at $850. They would take $850. You have $9. They have $950. I have $1,000 here in my book. They would take $1,100, and then they would be the winning bidder. So it's about doing that very quickly and with big numbers.
And with big numbers. And what about how do you get the most out of the room? What is it? What makes a successful auctioneer?
I think it's a bunch of different things. I mean, at least at Christie's, there's only there's only a few people who are auctioneers. So we ended up auctioneering everyone's department. So I don't know anything about Chinese works of art or post-war and contemporary art or watches, but I auctioneered all of those auctions. The key is, you want to put people at ease make it be seamless and make sure they're comfortable raising their hand. And you're trying to facilitate a transaction. I mean, in a commercial auction, the people are there because they want a specific bottle of wine mm-hmm. or a work of art. You're not necessarily at that point convincing someone that they're going to spend X amount of dollars on a vase or a bottle of DRC. That's sort of, they've made that decision. What you can do is get that one more bid out of them. That's really the key of the auctioneer, is to keep people bidding, to play people off of one another so that bidding keeps going up and up and up. You get caught up in it, and that's sort of the idea of an auction.
And the excitement.
The excitement, yeah.
You encourage people to attend auctions in person. They're going to...
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, they're fun,
right?
I mean, I work at Zaki's now, number one wine auction house. And our auctions are a blast. I mean, we have auctions at
number one in terms of like overall sales.
Overall sales in the markets we serve. So some other auction houses have auctions like all over Europe. We're not doing auctions in Geneva, for example. So, and our auctions are fun. I mean, in Hong Kong, our auctions are at the Mandarin Oriental. There'd be 125 people there. Here in New York, they're at Smith and Walensky, or they're at Le Bernardin, or numerous other restaurants we've held them at, and they're events. I mean, we'll have 100 people there. We open up tons of wine. People bring their own wine. Auctions are done over lunch. It's just a fun, they're free and open to the public. All auctions are free and open to the public. And it's just a fun way to spend a Saturday if you're into wine.
Jeez, that sounds amazing. I want to hear more about that. We're going to have to take just a quick break. We'll be back with more with Charles Anton from Zaki's Wine Auctions right after this.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels to lower barrel entry proof before heat cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's Cost Be Damn Taste Is Everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit michters.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
All right, we're back here with Charles Anton on In the Drink of Zacky's Wine Auctions. You know, Charles, I've always enjoyed the auctions that I've been to. I haven't gone to a ton of them, but I feel like it's a really great experience. I know we kind of touched on this before, but you really encouraged people to try to attend auctions. Do you think that it's worth it for, you know, for everyone, even if, say, you don't have a big budget or you're not even planning on buying wine? Can someone just go to an auction?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the big expensive wines are the ones that make the headlines and they're splashy and so forth. But that's not the majority of the wines being sold at auction. The best place to start for me is online auctions. Zacky's has an online auction every month, for example, 1,000 lots. You can buy wines in these auctions for, $30, $40. And what's cool about them is, number one, they're smaller lots. Like, if you want to buy something that you're not familiar with, it's not like you're committing to a case. But the other thing is, you know, if you're only drinking this kind of sort of, if you're only drinking mature Bordeaux, if you're only drinking Burgundy, you know, we sell wines from every region at auction, but it is somewhat French focused. But if you're only drinking Burgundy, if you're only drinking Bordeaux, you know, you're definitely missing out a huge portion of the wine industry. But, you know, conversely, like, if you only drink rosé or you're only drinking, you know, young German Riesling, I think you're missing out too. I mean, there's a reason that these sort of classic regions, Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, are what they are. And it's because they still make great wines. And they actually, you know, some people might not know this about a place like Bordeaux, but they actually make great wines at many different price points. And if you've never had wine with bottle age on it, a lot of these wines were meant to age and they improve with age. And that's sort of the reason to come to auction. You know, if you're buying wines with 5, 10, 15 years of bottle age from a retailer, oftentimes it depends where you live. But, oftentimes those retailers bought from auction. I mean, sometimes they're sourcing from private sellers, but oftentimes they bought from auction. So you can skip the middleman and come straight to an auction. So there's something to fit every budget, certainly. I mean, you've got to weed through, you know, if your budget's low, you know, you just tune out some of the more expensive stuff. But there's definitely fines in there, I'd say.
I feel like there's stuff to learn, too. And you have a great auctioneer who can sometimes give some really good insight into the lot that's coming up, to the wines that are coming up that maybe you don't know as someone who's just learning about wine still.
Yeah, I think so. Experience. I mean,
there's not a ton of time for that, right? You have to move through things, but
so the learning comes, like, it depends what you want to learn. I mean, if you're learning about the minutiae of the winemaking process of some of the wines sold at auction, you can do that by studying the catalogs. You can do it by talking to the people who work at the auctions. And obviously the best way is by coming to an auction. You know, we open up a ton of rare wine at our auctions. Our people who come bring things, and it's a very convivial atmosphere where everyone shares. Just tasting wines at an auction is a good way to go about it. During the auctions do go pretty quick, so you're not learning so much about the wines themselves at an auction. If you're interested in the market, the price of certain wines, you certainly learn a lot about that. But
can you think of a recent auction lot of wines that went up where, like, it was, I mean, I'm sure there's, like, just outstanding wines that come across, you know, across your table all the time. But, like, what is something that you're like, oh, I really would have liked to have tried that? That is a lucky, I mean, that's a lucky person. That's something that I would really, really like to taste.
Well, so it depends what hat I'm wearing. I mean, you know.
Personally, like, something personally, that you'd like to, like, bring home and, like, share with your wife.
I buy stuff at auction all the time. Like, yeah. And it's like, you know, I worked in Beaujolais. I worked at Vendange. Like, I worked a harvest in Beaujolais. And so, you know, those are the types of wines that, you know, you really don't see at auction that much, because even the most expensive Beaujolais, they're just not expensive enough to sort of move the needle in a commercial setting at an auction. But you do find them in online auctions and things like that. And sometimes great vintages like 09, you know, Cru Beaujolais, you can still find at auction for the price of that they were released at or less.
Oh, that's cool.
So, you know, for me, who likes to, and when I lived in France, like I was saying, I lived in the Loire Valley. So there's a soft spot in my heart for those wines. And if you've ever had 10, 15 year old Savinier or, you know, something like that, or older Chinon, you know, those wines, they're great young, but they do mature really elegantly. And for me, at least in my knowledge, the only way to get them is either to age them yourself or to buy them at auction. So, or unless you have some inns in France, the various cavistes and so forth.
But. Mm-hmm. And so you have a ton of things going on. You're doing a bunch of auctions. Can you kind of just give us an idea as to, like, I'm sure you don't have like an average week, but how much time do you spend? How many auctions do you do a year? What are some of the other things you have to do to prepare for an auction? What are the other responsibilities you have with Zaki's?
Sure. So the way that the auction season works is, you know, most of the wines we sell, almost all, are from private collections. We do offer winery direct wines at auction sometimes, but the majority of what we sell is private collections. So, and we work on a pretty big lead time. So, for example, this is being aired later, but as we sit here, it's the end of August, and we're preparing for a December auction now. And the reason for that is we travel the world to source private collections, and that might be quite literally anywhere in the world. I mean, we source wine from all over Europe, all over Asia. We either source or sell all over Asia, all over Europe, all over North and South America. The logistics are tricky. Everything is temperature controlled from point A to point B into our warehouse. And we've got to put together a catalog, which is then printed and disseminated among our clientele. So, you know, a lot of our time is spent traveling around, visiting with clients who are either buying from us or auction or potentially looking to sell their collections.
So you'd be part of the team that's actually like analyzing the seller and saying, is this exactly something that we think we can sell? Is this something that's authentic?
And yeah, people want to sell their wines at auctions for all different reasons. I mean, you know, they say the three D's of the auction business are death, divorce, and divestment. But, you know, that's a little bit of it. That's not really the case in the auction side. I mean, that's a little bit more on the estate side maybe. But, you know, at auction, people sell a lot of times because they've been collecting for a long time and then they suddenly realize they have more wine than they can drink. Sometimes people's tastes change. You know, they used to love California Cabernet. Now they drink white Burgundy.
Is that very common? That's kind of what I've heard on the periphery that like, and a couple of the collectors I met, like, they get into it with expensive, big cult cabs, and then as they learn more and taste more, they like more delicate and nuanced wines.
Yeah, I think there's certainly people like that, but I mean, you know, those Cabernets are
still selling.
They're still successful for a reason. I mean, people enjoy those. I mean, look, it goes the other way too, right? I mean, I have numerous clients who, for whatever reason, as they get older, sometimes those sort of delicate, nuanced Burgundies, they just don't taste like much when you get into your late 80s. You
need something a little more high impact.
Yeah, a little more high impact. Yeah. So, you know, it goes both ways, and it's for me personally. Like, I don't, you know, I like all the wines. I think there's a place for all of them. I don't want them all at the same time necessarily, but there's a place for each one. So,
and something I've been curious to ask you is, you know, when you got started, the auction world, I imagine, was very different from how it is now. How has it changed, especially with things like what happened with Rudy and the Billionaire's Vinegar and some of the, like, just, you know, some of the challenges that have come around wine authentication and some pretty, I don't know if they're sophisticated, but let's call them malicious guys out there.
Well, you know, the biggest change to wine auctions, number one, has been the popularity. I mean, they've grown quite a bit. You know, people, I went to Asia 5 times last year. I mean,
5 times
throughout. Yeah, it's a far way to go for 5 times a year. But people are all over the world getting more and more interested in the types of wines we sell at auction. So that's a big change. The internet auctions is a huge change. I mean, the internet auctions didn't exist when I started in the business. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, I started doing this 12 years ago. That's been a huge, huge change. And, you know, as far as counterfeits and so forth, you know, wherever there's a luxury good, people are going to try to counterfeit it. I mean, counterfeit paintings have been going on as long as there have been paintings. Counterfeit furniture. You know, you could walk down Canal Street. I'm sure you could find a Louis Vuitton. I'm sure someone will sell you a Louis Vuitton handbag. But it was only a matter of time as wine became more and more expensive that someone was going to try to counterfeit it. But, you know, the key is to just be diligent, to educate yourself on what's out there, who's doing what. Educate yourself about the fraud. Use the resources that you have. You know, close relationships with the chateau, with experts, and so forth. And, you know, wine's an interesting thing because, you know, I recently was in Bordeaux. Actually, it wasn't that recently anymore. It was a year ago. It was actually almost exactly a year ago today. And we were working with a négociant who has been a family-owned business that has been selling wine in Bordeaux for 250 years, and they're still owned by the same family. And they have the handwritten records from the 18th century, and they're all written in English because it was they weren't a French family. They were a négociant family living in France. Handwritten records.
Selling to London, probably.
Mm-hmm. A lot to London, yeah. But all over, actually. The U.S. was one of their biggest markets, actually. But they have handwritten recipes for Bordeaux. So, you know, take a barrel of Alicante, a barrel of Hermitage, mix it with, you know, two barrels of local wine, of claret. And there's recipes, there's requests from clients for different blends and so forth. So it just sort of throws into relief what we talk about when we talk about fake wine. I mean, would you call that fake wine? I don't know. I mean, it was, you know, there was no law against it, certainly, but it wasn't Bordeaux either. So certainly not what we think about as Bordeaux. We only talk about Bordeaux today, post AOC. But
that's amazing. But as the industry, I mean, like, I would be afraid to buy from, you know, a wine auction that I've never heard of, right? But I imagine that the major players like you guys have really take this stuff extremely seriously, right? Like,
of course,
has there been a step up in what everyone does at this point?
I think so. I think a couple things. You know, we take a lot of care to know the provenance of the wines we sell. We do a lot of research. Also, you know, if you're buying Sauvignon and $50 bottles of Bordeaux, I don't think you're at risk for counterfeiting.
No one's counterfeiting a $1 bill.
Right, exactly. Not that we know of, anyway. But, you know, I think that as when you would buy anything of value, you know, you just do a little homework. I mean, the team, myself and our team, are there to talk to you about where the collections came from and how they were stored, and nothing goes into our auctions that we don't stand behind. But, you know, it's always important to talk about the conditions. Like, some people care about label conditions, for example. But, you know, for me, I like a dirty label because it means, you know, a damp, cool cellar. Mm-hmm. Plus, it's, you know, looks nice. So,
yeah, yeah. It looks like it has that.
Yeah, you feel like you're Downton Abbey. Yeah, you know. It's nice.
Well, how do you guys decide what wines go to, like, the online auctions versus in person?
You know, the online auctions are focused on what we call, like, taster size lots. You know, we typically won't sell a original wooden case of Bordeaux in an auction unless it's fairly low value. The lots themselves are fairly low value. Not necessarily means the wines are low value, but the lots are. So if you had, you know, two bottles of wine, we might put it in a net sale, where as a full case in the original wood of the same wine, we might put in a live sale. But it's not a science. You know, there's different things in different auctions. I mean, and you find things that you might not think that you might find in a wine auction. Like, we had a huge collection of Clos Rougeard recently. Oh, yeah. in a wine auction. So,
You know what? With my opening, I'm going to come and look more at your online auctions. I've always, like, gotten the big catalog and, like, circled things and tried to go if I can, and if not, like, send in some bids for things. But I'm going to check out the online auctions. That sounds like a good way, especially if you don't have a ton of time.
Yeah, they're fun. I mean, it's like eBay style, right? They're open and then they close 10 days later. And if you're the winning bidder when they close, you win the lot. So,
I want to find some, like, old Burgundy, old Beaujolais.
Yeah, you can find it. I mean, you know, it depends. It's not like a retail experience where you walk into a store, hand a guy a credit card, he hands you a bottle of wine, and it's over. Like, you do have to, you know, you either have to enlist me or my colleagues to do the work for you, which is okay. Our job, and it's what we can do. If you say, hey, I'm looking for Old Beaujolais, shoot me an email when it comes up, we'll do that. Or if you, you know, more likely it's usually Burgundy from a certain producer, or, you know, a certain vintage of Bordeaux that's your mom's, you know, birth year or whatever it might be. And we'll let you know, you know, I'm looking for mature champagne from 1982. We'll let you know. But there is a little bit of, you know, we sell a lot of wine. There's some combing through of lists of wine to find some of the gems, which you sometimes have to do. But for me, like, that's part of the fun. You know, if you just want a bottle of red immediately to have with your pasta dinner, auction might not be the best. But if, you know, you have a little bit of storage and you can plan a little bit, then you're good. Then you're set.
Yeah, I think that's super exciting. I know you guys always have a lot of things going on. What's something where some of our listeners might be able to find you at? Is there a charity event coming up? Is there a Zaki's event that or auction coming up that our listeners can find you?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many charity events. The Zaki's events. So when is this? When are we going to be on the air?
Probably early September.
Okay. So
David, is that right? Early September.
Okay, so you'd like to come to a wine auction, we have one on September 15th and 16th at Smith & Walensky in New York City. And you can RSVP just by sending me a note.
Excellent. All right, Charles Hanton, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Charles Hanton, wine specialist, the senior international wine specialist and auctioneer at Zaki's Wine Auction, and my friend and neighbor in Brooklyn. I'll be seeing you around the hood soon. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks so much to all of you guys for listening. I want to thank David, who put the show together, and everyone at Heritage Radio Network. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.